Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Untangled Resolutions presentation of Sangoma, Stories from the Front Lines of Mediation. I am your host, Batabi Levin-Tombini, mediator and negotiation coach. Today, my guest is Laverna Fountain. We are talking about how her upbringing in a tiny Pennsylvania town during the midst of the civil rights movement has influenced her journey into the world of alternative dispute resolution. This proved to be a fantastic conversation. I'm so looking forward to this. Hi, Laverna. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm so glad to be here.
Wonderful. You know, I have each of my guests fill out an information form that asks them questions about their lives and their inspirations in alternative dispute resolution. And reading yours was just amazing, beginning with where you grew up. I'd like to talk about the life experiences that have influenced your journey into using conflict management and dispute resolution in your own work. First, you grew up in a really tiny town. You say it's about 3,000 people now and shrinking. What was that like?
Well, you know, I consider myself very fortunate to have grown up in a little town called Mount Union, Pennsylvania. And last count, it's probably under 3,000 people at this point. But growing up there, I think really grounded me in ways that I count a high blessing now. Everybody, first of all, knew everybody.
I'm sure.
So that always counts for something. You know, you really can't hide too much. Except for during that time frame, of course, what went on behind closed doors, there was just the general unspoken agreement that you don't really talk about. But once you stepped out of those doors, you really had a community of people that really might not look like you, but cared about you. And I would say everybody there was struggling. So, you know, we all had the same kind of situation of take care of each other, take care of yourself, watch out for your neighbor. And I count that just a high privilege, especially when I think about what I'm looking at today and people who are struggling economically. In my home, I can tell you that my mother always cooked a larger amount of food than we actually needed. And it wasn't necessarily healthy food. We were having lots of beans and rice and soup, but there was always enough because we knew more than likely someone would stop by the house at dinner time.
Okay.
They were hungry. And so you learn to take care of each other.
So it really was a town where you could just drop by. You didn't have to call ahead of time. It was expected that you'd visit each other for meals and so forth.
Well, the interesting thing, it's so, you know, as a much older adult now, it was completely different then. Doors did not get locked. And so that just was not something you worried about. You knew you would go to your neighbor's house. Once when I was a very small child, and I'm African-American, a very small child, I remember I was walking home from elementary school, and I had to go to the bathroom. And I walked and knocked on a stranger's door and said, "Can I please use your bathroom?" And it was a woman was Caucasian, and she said, "Of course." I mean, it just was a very different kind of thought process than I encounter today.
Right. And I actually can commiserate with you on that and share that, because I also grew up in a small town where a lot of people knew each other. It was a little bit larger, but I can imagine being in my neighborhood and doing the same thing. So, yes, I quite can relate in terms of things having really changed. You said that even with people who didn't look quite the same as you did, you felt really comfortable. Tell me a little bit more about that. It sounds like your town was rather integrated.
Well, I think it was integrated for different reasons. First of all, Mount Union was one of the stops on the Underground Railroad.
Oh.
And so that's how black people got there to begin with. And, you know, I didn't know that until later on, but of course there was this enclave. And I would say, in hindsight, there were areas where black people lived and the areas where the white people lived, and that's just how it was. Then there was an area where all of the poorer people lived, the projects. But in the projects, it's where we all lived. And so my next door neighbor was white, and you know, the woman in the row next to us, you know, was white, and Latino. And so there, you know, we just had that kind of mix that would happen.
You know, it's an interesting thing that you bring that up. I think that the common plight of poor people, no matter what ethnicity, is something that folks are more aware of today. And it's interesting that your town was actually sort of arranged around those lines, that perhaps more affluent blacks lived in one neighborhood, more affluent whites lived in one neighborhood, but poor people were all just poor.
We were all just poor. We were all just trying to make it, and we all watched out for each other. And for me, I can vividly see the faces of my neighbors, and they did not look like me. And at the same time, my family was all around, my aunts, my uncles, my cousins. And so we were all there, friends, you know. And because it was a small town, it's one of those places where if your parents grew up and they all came up together from the South, they were aunts and uncles too, even though we weren't blood related. That family was very large.
Right, right. You know, I'd like to talk a little bit more about your family. You describe a situation where there is, you know, quite a great deal of poverty. There's alcoholism in your family. There's physical violence in your family. At the same time, you say that you knew with absolute certainty that you were 100% loved, and that if anything happened, you could rely on your parents 100%. And I'm interested in how that sort of, in one sense, it seems a contradiction. On the other hand, this is what worked in your family.
It is what worked, and I'm not sure I'll ever really be able to explain it except to acknowledge that it is. So we had this massive dysfunctionalism. My father, my biological father, was definitely an alcoholic. He was a working alcoholic, so Monday through Friday he went to work. Friday when he got off work, he brought his check home, went out, got drunk, that was it. Saw him again, you know, either when he and my mother were fighting sometime during that weekend or when it was time for him to go back to work Monday. So very, very tense dynamics. My mother was angry. She had been married before, and her first husband had beat her up significantly several times, even while she had been pregnant. She had learned a long time that at some point she was going to have to start to defend herself. And by the time she married my father, she had become this very angry woman, just angry, I think, angry at how life had treated her. She had to drop out of school before she was out of the ninth grade so she could help take care of her family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the poverty that she grew up in was the kind of stuff that people write about. Mm. Really, the dirt floors, needing to go to the river to get their water. And so I think within her there was massive anger. And somehow, by the time myself and my sister were born, I had two older brothers, but by the time my sister and I were born, it was obvious for her that her life was not going to be maybe what all of her dreams declared she wanted. And instead, she married this man who she thought was going to save her, and there he was with his own problems. My father was a foster child, and he had his own issues that never got healed. So we had two wounded people who now were together raising what turned out to be four kids in this blended family in a place where poverty was the norm, and where this, even though through my eyes I saw everyone getting along, they grew up, of course, you know, in very difficult racial, ethnic, challenging times in the United States. And so they carried the burden of that in how they saw what was going on. And I'm reminded, election time now, actually, that when Obama was first running, I remember I took a sign home for my father, still living in Mount Union. And I said, "Here, Pops, put the sign in the yard." And he said, "There's no way I'll do that. Someone will burn my house down." Now, I was shocked that he would say something like that. That was
this
like
is, what, 3 years ago?
Yeah, unbelievable to me that he would think that he would be harassed in any way because he was supporting Obama. But because the wounds in his life still significantly impacted him, he said, "I can't do that." And in fact, you know, Mount Union is small. It's surrounded by mountains. There is an active Klan population there, Ku Klux Klan population there. But in our little town, that did not happen. But obviously my father had some other experiences, enough to make him afraid to even put an election sign in his yard.
That is deep and incredible and painful to hear.
Very painful. Because at that point, my father was 78, and when I saw the fear in his face, I, of course, moved into a whole other space of what do I need to do to protect my dad? And then I was very much, having lived and traveled, saying, how can you still think that's something that would happen? But obviously in his life, he had had enough scars that said to him, I can't trust this thing happening in the United States that so significantly shifts the way we view people of color.
My goodness. It makes me wonder about the specifics of his upbringing, the things that he experienced in his life that are so salient that they should be so present in him today. Even you know, all these years since the Civil Rights Movement and, since the various presidents who have been elected and the laws that have been enacted. But you're living in a town and you say there's an active Klan community nearby. It's not in the Union, but it's nearby, and apparently it still has an impact and an influence.
Well, I think that fear is an amazing thing, right?
So,
even if it's only one person who says I'm Klan, if you've got a history where something has happened, it can cause you to be afraid. Now, I have no doubt that there are people in the area surrounding my little town that either are still active in the Klan or who have relatives who are. I think it's very small, and every now and then they make their presence known. They'll write a letter. Some years back, not too long ago, actually, I had a cousin who was the chief of police in that little town, and the Klan published an article in the paper, wrote an opinion letter that basically reminded my cousin that even though he was chief of police, they still controlled the town. And he had to be careful because they would remove him if they needed to.
You mentioned
that's bizarre.
You mentioned control, and that is immediately what came to my mind when you talked about fear, when you started highlighting this issue of fear, and I thought, my goodness, what kind of control that is to have over people. The fact that you went back to town with an Obama sign and suggested that your father place it in the front yard says that you're not perhaps affected in the same way, and yet you grew up in that town. You were raised by your parents. How might you account for that?
Well, for me, things remain a little bit bizarre in that in my home, everybody was welcome. And that is the nature of that town, the environment. A white lady opened up her home if I had to go to the bathroom as a little girl. In my home, people came through. I can vividly remember when some migrant farm workers were moving through town, and they moved into a place near us, and I would just go play with them, and the children would come and play at our house, and we would just hang out. And I remember thinking, I don't know this culture, and I don't know this language, but they were welcome in our home. And I was welcome, and my mother let me spend the night in their house. And again, we were all, at that point, we had moved out of the projects. We had moved into a different area of the town. But we were all understanding that, you know what, we need each other. Mm-hmm. And my mother, I think, created an environment that said it didn't matter. Now, she spent her life cleaning people's homes.
Okay.
And I remember, being sad sometimes about that. Because she would spend her full day going to scrub someone else's floors and clean someone else's house and cook someone else's meals. And, for instance, at Thanksgiving time in my family, we celebrate Thanksgiving on Saturday. That's a leftover tradition from that time frame of being raised when my mother on Thanksgiving would have to go and cook someone else's meal. And so we didn't do Thanksgiving on that day. We did it on Saturday when she was home
and
with
you
us.
Do it.
We still do it. It is absolutely the tradition in my home. It worked out so much better, I have to tell you. We don't rush. It's it's much better. It just is. And, you know, you get married, it's no problem. We got, the husband and wife thing, it works out. So Saturday is my day.
Look at that. Talk about an ironic blessing.
It was an ironic blessing, and you look at that. But I do remember being saddened by it.
Yes.
And so I think that also added to my mother's anger. It added to, my mother is very smart, so if my mother had been able to complete school, I don't know where she would have been, because she was amazingly smart, and she could really stretch food, and she could maneuver around all the systems to get her children what she wanted for her children. My dad, I didn't find out until he passed away that he, too, was brilliant. Now, I only knew the alcoholic man, but at his funeral, I distinctly remember sitting there thinking, who is this person they're talking about?
Amazing.
And it was one of his friends who said, your father was a math genius. He never had a calculator, but he could correct the bank tellers when they messed up his money.
My goodness.
I thought, people do carry these scars and wounds, and I happen to be the beneficiary of both some of their scars and wounds, but also their tremendous love. And you said, sometimes that sounds contradictory as we recognize this dysfunctional family, but I knew without a shadow of a doubt that if I were ever in trouble, my mother and my father would be at the top of the line, moving everybody out the way to get to me, to make sure I was okay. That goes a long way to helping someone like me, who had all the other issues of having grown up in a dysfunctional home, come to light and say, but I know I'm loved. It was a love that carried me.
And, not everybody has that, who lives in a tremendously dysfunctional, from some perspectives, all families are dysfunctional.
Yes, indeed, yes.
But some families are more dysfunctional than others, and it is an amazing thing to be able to come out of that and still know that I am loved. That is a core need, and we know what happens with folks who grow up not understanding that they are loved. So that is a tremendous, we want to talk about blessings, that's a tremendous blessing as well. You talk about strong women in your family, and I was curious about that. Tell me what that means for you.
Well, I have to tell you, I grew up in the culture where the women were dominant. They just were. And so I have difficulty sometimes relating to the women's movement. I have difficulty understanding some of the women's issues, because I grew up where women did whatever it took, whatever it takes to get it done. Like, there weren't question marks on it. There were no time to say what you will or won't allow me to do. The women in my family did and still do whatever it takes. And I see that in my cousins, my female cousins now, that they have some of that same tenacity. And I recognize that as a family cultural trait for us. Sometimes the stereotype says that's how African-American women were.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know,
heard that.
I don't know if that, right? We do whatever. we will work three jobs, go home, clean the house, put the food on the table, raise the kids, raise someone else's kids. We will do whatever it takes. That stereotype happened to be true in my family, but that came at a high cost.
Well, I am curious about how it impacted gender relations in your family.
I didn't understand the species called men. I really did not. And that, if I say, if there's anything, when I look at it now, when I add it to an alcoholic father and an angry mother, it really talks to the trajectory of what my life was like. So I left Mountain Union unsure what one should do. I'd gone to school, I graduated from high school, but now what? So I decided to go into the Army, because in small towns, armies, military is often the pathway out. You can make some money, you've got housing, you're going to have a community, you're going to be taken care of. So I joined the Army. My two brothers did not want me to do that. In fact, I had originally signed up to go into the Air Force, and my brothers tore my paperwork up and told me, No, they did. They tore it up because at that time, now this was in 75, at that time they said there are only two kinds of women that go into the military. And the words they called me, neither was nice.
Oh, my.
And so they tore my paperwork up and told me I would be neither of those women. And so I went behind their backs and said, well, I'll go to the Army. They won't let me go to the Air Force. I'll go to the Army. And I got in the Army, and I didn't understand how to relate to men. I didn't understand anything about relating to men at all.
It seems to me that the idea of men as authority figures would be kind of foreign to you.
I think I didn't recognize them as that. I
can see how this could be a problem in the Army.
So I can say, so for me, and you know, people yell and they get in your face, and I would just look at them like it was a weird thing. Like, what are you doing yelling at me? First of all, a yell in my house meant fight. So that was, I remember having to constantly fight that energy inside of me, because if someone yelled at me, that meant get ready, get a knife, knock someone out.
A knife?
And that was... Oh, because in my home, that happened sometimes. And my mother, there were times my mother would just pick up the closest instrument and use it with my father. And so that was part of the madness, I believe. You know, I'd come home sometimes and I'd find my father sitting in the floor, and there would be blood there, or he'd be, you know, drunk. And that was what happened behind our closed doors. So that was who I was inside. That was what would get triggered inside of me when someone would yell, because raised voices meant fight.
Right.
And the other thing that actually did happen to me was I always, for that first year and the maybe first year and a half in the military, I always thought I would get a call and one of my parents would have killed the other one. And so I did start to seek some help in the military, because I had this thing in me that said one of my parents is going to kill the other one.
But let me ask you this. It sounds as though then you might have had a sense that your presence in the home, the presence of your siblings in the home, might have acted as a buffer.
Well, I absolutely believed, and I was the baby, so there was a point when it was only me, and I think, and it was 3 years when it was only me, and so I think those last 3 years left some serious scars, because when my sister was there, she was a buffer, and she was a buffer for me, and when my brothers were there, they were buffers, and then there was a period where they were all gone, and I felt abandoned. I remember feeling very abandoned by my sister. Like, how could you leave me? How could you leave me here? How could you leave me? You know what this is like. So when I was in the military, I did take advantage of some of their services and start to see a counselor to address that fear in me that I would need get a call and I would not be able to get home in time to protect one of my parents.
And it's interesting you say one of your parents, because you describe your mother attacking your father, but it sounds like it kind of went both ways.
Well, when I was much younger, much younger, my father, I don't know that my father ever hit my mother, but I remember there was a time when he raised his hands as if he was going to. And when he did that, all of my aunts, who were probably at best 5 feet tall, and that was with high heels, would come, and godmothers, and literally it looked like they came from out of the walls, because when my father raised his hand, they just came from everywhere and moved. At the time, my mother had just been in an accident, and she was laying on the couch, and she had stitches in her forehead, and so she was in a vulnerable position when my father raised his hand. But I remember my godmother saying, if you hit her, it will be the last time you will ever use that hand. And as a young girl, I looked around the room, and I saw my father was then surrounded probably with about six black women who were all relatives of my mother's, and my father saw it too. And so he lowered his hand, and he never, ever did anything like that again, ever, never. But that was the point where I think I saw my mother see a turning point. And for her, she saw something else that she could do.
So I'm wondering, in terms of, you know, masculinity in your home and your brothers as well, witnessing that, is that something that you talk about or wonder about in terms of how they were impacted?
You know, I never wondered about it for my brothers. I probably should have, and I never did. My two oldest brothers, we lost one of them tragically. He drowned when he was 26.
Oh, dear.
And because the alcoholism and drug addiction continued in my family.
Oh.
And my oldest brother jumped in a river, and my brother jumped in after him to make sure he was okay, and instead he drowned.
Oh.
And so that caused enormous problems in our family for a long, long time, very long time. I never took the time to say, how did this relationship impact them? I recognized my father was not their biological father, and I knew that impacted them. I knew that they wanted to at least know their biological father, who had been the person who had abused my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that my oldest brother actually became an abuser as well to his wife. And my mother said, you know, would not tolerate that and let him know that she would not tolerate him doing to his wife what his dad had done to her. My father, to them, I think they respected him because he helped to raise them, but I think there was definitely a disconnect. And in fact, my two brothers were big, and they were football players and wrestlers, and in the small town, you know, that meant them, that people liked them a lot, and they were very popular. And so my father actually would sometimes use them, and if he was being in any way tormented, he would tell people, "I'm going to sick Henry and Jerome on you."
My goodness.
And so for me, the understanding of the male-female connections, how we relate to each other, definitions of masculinity versus femininity, all messed up. I haven't got a clue. So, you know,
Or at least different, perhaps, Laverna. You know, I have to say that I have my own sort of radical notions about whether those roles are in any way concrete or even natural, if you want to say it, put it that way, that every society has its own understandings of what masculinity and femininity are. And while this is different from what I suppose would be the norm in a more conventional sense, it is also something that I hear in other contexts as well, what was going on in that situation. So I wonder whether it's just different.
You know, I just say it just is. You know, but for certain, I didn't understand how to navigate.
Mm-hmm.
Because growing up in a small town, very conservative town, the church was right next door to my house, so I was the Sunday school teacher, pianist, choir director, you know. So I had all of those pressure points giving me one definition of who we were.
Yes.
Then I would go home, and there was another definition of what took place behind closed doors. And then there was this other definition of what took place when other people were around. So I was simply a very confused individual. And I think ultimately I started to just say, you know, I don't understand men, so I'm not even going to try to do that part. And for me, since I didn't take on the idea that there were things I could not do, it was more about do what you can do. Do it, just go do it. Just do it. Whatever it takes, go do it.
Well, you know, I'd love to get into that, and we will talk a bit about what happened when you were in the Army. But you mentioned your brothers, and you say that one of your brothers started a riot.
Yes, that was my oldest brother. He was very popular, very, very popular. So this was in the 60s, right after King had got assassinated. And my brother's best friend was white. But I believe he was not, my brother, Henry, was not addressing some of the very confused feelings happening inside of him, recognizing we had all this racial unrest in the country. So in this very small town of Mount Union,
right. Let's actually come back a little, because there's a little bit of a lead up to that. You mentioned that this riot happened after Dr. King was assassinated, but even before that, you and your family participate in commemorating him after the assassination. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, here, again, for me, this, I think, you know, if I ever spend any real time, I'll go back and do some real studying on this, but because Mount Union was a stop on the Underground Railroad, I think there was this other strain going on in the black people who lived in Mount Union. And that was the something that was passed down from generation to generation that said, we can do this. So King was assassinated, and one of the things that Coretta Scott King said she wanted to do was continue his march, his poor people's march. Mm-hmm. And so the church I belong to decided to take a bus. Now, for me, the high point of this is to remember that we were very poor. And so as a community, this out of the poverty, there was something else that happened that said they killed our king. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you grew up in that time frame, typically in a household, you had at least two, if not three, photographs hanging on your wall. One was Jesus Christ, and one was Martin Luther King. Now, mm-hmm. some families had Jesus Christ, Martin Luther King, and John F. Kennedy. And so we had come through this thing that was really shaking the foundation of understanding who we are. And so a bus was going to come to D.C., and my mother made sure we were on it. Mm-hmm. And we got on the bus, and we came to D.C., and we're marching, and it was muddy, and I didn't understand what was going on, and I look up, and beside me is Martin Luther King's sister, and the people are passing her along, literally lifting her up so she doesn't have to be in the mud, so she can be at the front of the line.
Mm.
And I remember, through a child's eyes, looking at that, recognizing that I was in a significant place at a significant time, doing something of significance, not necessarily connecting all the dots, but I remember also looking at my mother with great pride.
Yes.
Because I knew some courage had happened, because the person who we saw as leader of our people had been brutally murdered. And yet, here we were. Now, you can bring me back, but I have to tell you, the connect that from that moment to many years later,
mm-hmm.
because it so significantly changed my life. Many years later, I had been working with teenagers and trying to teach them about Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi, and this was a long time later. And there was something called a Million Man March.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working with these teenagers. About 70 teenagers were coming to my house. By then, I was married, and my own children were teenagers. And I just thought, what is going on in this world? Because we were going through another wave of violence. And so about 70 teenagers had been coming to my house, and I was teaching them about nonviolent social change.
Uh-huh.
And trying to see if there was anything of relevance to their world. And literally, I had not been trained in it, so I didn't know what I was doing,
mm-hmm.
but I would get my hands on everything I could and read and study. And that march that I did with my mother right after King was assassinated constantly resonated with me. And so I'd be teaching the young people, and I would think, there's got to be something that they can grab a hold of about who King was and who Mahatma Gandhi was. And they did. And then the Million Man March came up, and I had young men who I was working with, young black guys, and I was struggling because I was not breaking through. It was much easier for me to break through to some of the Latino girls, some of the black girls, some of the white guys I was working with. But
mm-hmm.
the black guys, I was not making as much progress as I wanted to. There was anger inside. There was low self-esteem. There was confusion. And I thought, I'm not breaking through. They can't hear from me. So maybe if they go to the Million Man March, just maybe they will see something that will change their life and give, let them be a part of something that had so much changed my life many years before that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did. My husband took them. And he took some of the young men with him to allow them to experience what it meant to be among Black men who were proud, Black men who were honest, Black men who were working, Black men who cared about their children, Black men who were engaged in their family. And I thought that was extremely significant for them and for me. And by the way, I snuck in after my husband left. I snuck and drove myself down so I could see the Williams place in Death March.
And can't let the dudes do it all by themselves.
That's right. You know, that's right. What I saw was something really that was life-changing for some of those young men there.
Mm. You know, you mentioned that it was life-changing for you to be at the march and to see Dr. King's sister being passed up, and, of course, this opportunity for the young men whom you had been working with to experience a similar thing. Because there's something, as you're saying, about being amongst a huge multitude of people who are commonly focused, but, you know, commonly determined toward a positive end, of course, is going to have a huge impact. So, you know, I am going to bring you back. You went to this march in Washington. You come back, and was your brother or your brothers with you?
You know, I don't remember my brothers on that bus. I actually do not remember them on the bus. I remember my sister. I remember my mother. I don't remember my brothers.
Okay.
And I believe that means they probably weren't there, mm-hmm. because there's an age span of about 6 years between me and my brothers,
okay.
and I looked up to them. They were everything to me. And had they been there, I believe I would have latched on to that, even in my memory. I would have latched on because it would have just raised their profile in my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So that also could be part of what happened with my brother. After King was assassinated, my brother, who had something going on inside of him, took a fist and broke his best friend's jaw, and that night started a riot.
Do you know what started the fight?
No, and neither does my brother, who did it, who started it. And I asked him, and so did many other people, and his only response was, "I don't know." And I believe "I don't know" was an honest answer for him, because somewhere deep in him, there was so much turmoil, he didn't know. And he struck out at the person closest to him, his best friend, someone who he loved. He struck out because the assassination of King took him over so that he was no longer able to hold within his anger. And he just struck out. He took his fist and hit.
I can imagine, and maybe I'm reading things into it with retrospect and so forth, but I can imagine that perhaps he had to look at his best friend in a different way in the aftermath of this assassination.
Well, I think at that moment, he probably looked and he saw white.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very sad, because before that he saw his best friend. Before that he saw someone he hung out with. And yet, after that, he saw another white person versus another friend.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, later he regretted it. I mean, he put his friend in the hospital, you know.
He hit him hard enough to break his jaw.
He broke his jaw.
That's a hit.
And, you know, after that, things started, you know, people started tearing things up and looting and burning and doing all the things that people associate with riots. And, you know, my brother definitely regretted what he did. But I think at that moment when he did it, he no longer saw his friend. He
mm-hmm.
no longer saw his friend at all. He only was able to see something that for him had crossed the line, and that was the assassination of King.
Now, I'm curious about why people responded by rioting. First of all, who was rioting? Was it everybody who's rioting? Is it a particular part of the community? And is there a sense of why the response to what ostensibly is a fight between two people should end up engulfing the town?
Well, I think because riots were going on throughout the United States by then. Mm-hmm. So I think there was also this part of, this is happening. The U.S. is burning. The revolution is not televised. We've got to be a part of this thing. And I think so there was a part of that happening. My brother happened to have been, because he was this great football player and very popular, also just somebody in town that people looked up to. So if he's doing it, then we must do it. This is the call. Something, it was like lighting the flame. And when it was going on, and so for them, they saw examples of it happening in other cities. Mm-hmm. So why would it not happen in this small town, Mount Union?
Mercy.
And, you know, the cops would come out, but and so what? You know, the by this time, there was something that united this small town with the big cities in Chicago and L.A., you know, and so they had to recognize that they were part of something much larger, just as King was a part of something much larger. And so it all, I believe, became a very confused, ugly mess, because for that moment, people forgot who we were in that small town.
Mm. And it is amazing, because you describe a situation where at least, you know, for poor people, if not in a larger sense, there was that sense of community when it's a town that is small. I suppose one doesn't have as much of a luxury in terms of discriminating. You know, you just can't do it necessarily. And yet you have this riot go on, and now the town has changed.
Right. And I'm not sure how the town healed. I know that it did. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how it healed. Mm-hmm. And the reason, I was just home a few weeks ago, and it, you know, people are very much neighbors again, and people take care of each other, and people watch out for each other. But that was a time in the U.S. history where I think everything was completely shaken to the core. And I wonder about it now, not just from the small town Mount Union, but I wonder about it from the small country of the United States, who has to fit into the whole global place of what does it mean. And I know that could be hard to kind of get your hands around, but in poverty, we watched out for each other in that small town. In poverty, we were there for each other. You know, if I did something at school before I got home, everybody knew, because first of all, the principal would call my parents, and, you know, my neighbors knew, and I'm walking home a few blocks, and, you know, neighbors are saying, you in trouble, you in trouble, you know, you might want to stop here.
Right, it puts a whole other spin on the idea of the walk of shame, doesn't it?
Yeah, completely, right? Completely. But and you know, we knew, and that's just how it was. You know, I had, you know, aunts who, you know, were there, like, you know, I'm gonna beat your butt when your mom get done with you. You know, so it was family, community family. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing for me is after 9/11, that happened in the United States, right?
Right.
The
yeah.
whole country. The whole country became a community family. Right. We watched out for each other. We looked. But I don't know what I'm looking at right now. I'm seeing tension again in the United States, and people segregating themselves again. And I don't know what we're really thinking, what we're doing. For we had a moment when we recognized we're all in this together, and we lost that. And I saw that happen with the riot in Mount Union. Most of the time, we recognize we're all in together, and then something happened, and we broke apart.
Mm-hmm.
In Mount Union, they've come back together, mm-hmm. and I think he is going to be finding out how can we help throughout town, city, neighborhood, community, people come back together again to recognize we all are in this together.
Right.
And even though we look different, we may practice different religions or no religion at all. We may actually have different socioeconomic backgrounds, but we're all here. This is it. Sorry, guys, this is it. Planet Earth, that's all we got.
And I know this is something that you're particularly interested in right now, and I think your path to it is really interesting as well. You did mention that you joined the Army, and one of the things you said in the form that you sent back to me that I found to be pretty particularly interesting and somewhat amusing was that although that you joined the Army, you were really impacted by the idea of nonviolence, and you didn't want to kill anybody.
I had no desire to kill a soul. And I love shooting a gun, and so that may not come together for people, but I grew up in the country, and so you shot guns, and, you know, that was part of it. I was part of 4-H, and, you know, you learned how to handle a gun appropriately, and I like to go to the range, and I like to shoot. But the idea of actually shooting another human being, very difficult for me.
Hmm.
The thought that I might have to hurt someone, not just kill them, the thought of hurting them brought back all kinds of bad feelings. It was the stuff I grew up in. I didn't want to hurt anybody.
Right.
And I had to be, and oh, and then I was in military police, so that really made it even more difficult, right? Because you had to arrest people, and you had to do stuff, and I'm like, I don't know how I got in that situation.
Mm.
And I distinctly remember going to my colonel and saying, I can't do this. I can't do this. I just can't do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to kill anybody. I'm not going to do it. And they wound up putting me in, still with the military police, but in a situation where I was not, where I did not need to guard people all the time or arrest people.
So they brought me to the office. Yeah.
I'm sorry?
So they did honor it.
They absolutely did honor it. I think they thought I was lying, actually.
Really?
I really think they said, "There's something's wrong with this woman. She's talking about she can't do it, but, you know, we know she can shoot." Because I had an expert badge in shooting, so they knew I could shoot. And so they didn't, I think they really didn't know what to do with me at all. And I'm not sure I knew to do with myself, because I was definitely still growing and learning and confronting all those conflicting emotions inside of me.
Right. But how do you come to adopt nonviolence in the first place?
You know, it was King. It definitely was Martin Luther King. And then when I started looking at King, I realized he looked to Gandhi. And I had the awesome privilege of being a director for a former U.S. Senator, Harris Walford, mm-hmm. who was one of the advisors to Martin Luther King. And so while I was on this journey myself, and working with the teenagers, I was making a living by working with this man who had advised King on nonviolence. And I was introduced then to Coretta Scott King and to Dick Gregory and to people who had just been so deeply engaged in the nonviolent movement. And I think sometimes I just sat and just listened to their passion and understood there was more to this. And then as I studied nonviolent social change, I was like, well, this makes sense to me. I didn't know if I could do it. I didn't know, because there was too much in me that was conflicted, but it made sense to me. Mahatma Gandhi made so much sense to me. It made sense to me that these Christian beliefs that I held true, if I really looked back and said, if I'm going to take Jesus at his word, he said, turn the other cheek, can I really do that?
Mm. Especially growing up in a family where you didn't.
It, not only didn't you, you would have got beat up if you pretended like you were going to do something like that.
Right.
Because we were expected to fight and to be the best at fighting. And so for me then, there became this whole notion of exploring whether or not nonviolence was relevant for me.
Mm-hmm.
Could I do that? Could I embrace that? Now, I also, during this time frame when I was exploring nonviolence, I didn't understand things like conflict resolution. Yeah. That made no sense to me at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ADR folks, yeah, right. I didn't believe anything anyone told me about that.
But I'm curious about why that was. I mean, what about it turned you off?
It was a system. For me, it was an organized something or other, and since it was organized, it must therefore not be valid. And that was how I looked at things.
So deep suspicion of anything that looks like establishment.
Yeah, very deep suspicion of it. Very, very deep. But I also believe it was deep, and also it was not just distrustful of the system, it was distrustful of me. how could it be that this was out there all this time and I didn't know about it?
Mm.
How could that be? Where were they when I was growing up and the fights were going on in my home?
Mm.
This is impossible. It is literally impossible. They could not have had all these resources and somehow those resources overlooked it. Otherwise, I wouldn't have the scars that I have. Otherwise, my heart wouldn't have been broken. Otherwise, I wouldn't have thought that my parents would kill each other. It's impossible.
Mm. You talk
I think that there are parts there.
Pardon?
I think there were parts of that for me that was definitely, it just didn't make sense that there could be other people who believed in nonviolence or believed in resolving conflict peaceably, believed in addressing conflict in a way that left people whole. To me, those pieces simply did not come together at all.
Right. And as you're saying, you know, where were they? Where were you when I needed you?
Right. Right. I guess I did not understand it, and therefore I distrusted a system that somehow didn't reach me.
Mm. You mentioned David Sawyer and a speech that he gave called Divided No More.
I love David Sawyer so much. I love him so much. David Sawyer is a Buddhist, and I don't know what event I was at, but he gave a speech called Divided No More, and you know, I owe him so much for that speech. I owe him because I listened to him, and I thought, that's me. I'm so divided. I'm so, so divided. If you touched me wrong, I might hit you. And yet inside of me, I wanted so desperately to find other ways of resolving my conflict. And I didn't understand all of the anger in me. And then there's this white guy, this Buddhist, and he's saying, he's talking about the first place you have to resolve conflict is within yourself. You have to determine that you will be divided no more. You'll line up your thinking, your intellect with your spirit, with your physical, and you'll recognize that your whole being and your whole being and your whole self have to pursue something. And so who will you be? Who will you become? What path will you walk? What will you decide to do? The first step is to be divided no more.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he said that, it was like somebody came through there it was like a thunderstorm clearing out my brain and my heart, and I heard for the first time, I heard that it's possible. I heard, my ears were able to open up and hear that in fact I could pursue something that may make me whole.
And that you couldn't do it until you had resolved that tension and that divide within your own self.
Yeah, and at least to acknowledge that it was there, to start the journey by understanding I was at the beginning of at least recognizing I was so fractured. I was a fractured individual, and I had to become whole.
And, you know, the beautiful thing about that is you might feel overwhelmed and helpless in the face of an entire community where you're looking at, you know, fractions and so forth, fractures, but you can deal with what's going on with yourself. That is something that you can control.
Yeah, and in the end, you know, it may be the only thing you can do. You know, you when you deal with yourself, that will in fact influence others, because everything we do in fact will influence someone else. But if you're not even taking the time to recognize that it's inside of you, what you're walking into will be much more difficult to deal with. And so for David Sawyer, in his speech, Divided No More, it has forever impacted my life to be able to say, when I look at something called nonviolent social change, or I look at something that says there's a way to resolve this conflict peaceably, I listen to people, and you had them on your show, Marty Epstein, who talks about nonviolent communication and the ability to gain real listening skills to hear other people. And hearing, to me, is probably the thing that I am most both grappling with and grateful for, because if I take the time to listen and to really hear, not just with my ears but with my heart, what a magnificent difference it makes.
Oh, yes. And the thing about you that's great is that you're actually walking the walk. You mentioned that you had tension with ADR, but that you've come a long way as far as that is concerned, and embraced it and actually even use it in your own work. Tell me about what's going on with that. We have about 5 minutes left to chat about that, but I do want to know what's going on today.
So I have a company called Defiant Hope, and it comes from really a few things, but it comes from a few decades of listening to people struggle. And my work I did with the teenagers, and then work I started to do throughout the country, helping people to, I think, consider beginning the journey that I myself had to consider, and or meeting people on the journey they were already on and saying to them, even though life might have dealt you a sucker punch, enough to knock the wind out of you, you've got to possess something called defiant hope. Defiance with your hope that will allow you to get up in the face of great adversity and still believe in a better tomorrow and a better today. And it has been literally the foundation of now what I do. And before we talked today, I just came back from the Finger Lakes in New York, where I was talking with a group of direct support professionals who are on the front lines every day working with people who have physical and mental disabilities and the challenges they face. And if ever there was a profession that needed someone to say, walk with defiant hope, I believe that's one. Because they're working in some of the areas that people least want to be a part of, and yet they're making the most dramatic changes.
Wow.
So for me, defiant hope, and I will just tell you what it stands for, what the definition of defiant hope is, it is to withstand with a bold, stubborn, unreasonable rebellion any negative circumstance, force, or thing that would threaten to steal your dream. I absolutely believe that within this world, we have everything we need to accomplish what we need to help humanity be the best it can be. But people want to steal your dreams and your hope, and you have to withstand that. And you have to look in the face of stuff, even when it's ugly, and I believe I had some ugly stuff happen in my life, and say, but there's so much better. There's so much more we can do. Just like I had the ugly stuff happen in my life, I had amazingly beautiful things come my way, amazing opportunities, amazing blessings, because for whatever reason, that thing called defiant hope was still there. I take it back to the fact that no matter what, I knew I had parents who loved me. In all the dysfunctionalism, I had parents that absolutely loved me.
Yes. Oh, what a beautiful, beautiful story. At least it's beautiful in the way that it has worked out. There are other things in terms of your trajectory that also are amazing. I mean, you come from this very small town. You have parents who grew up in abject poverty. Your mom didn't finish high school, and yet you've completed a master's program from one of the top universities in the country and the world.
And here's what I tell people. Put your dreams out to the universe and tell the universe what you want. For me, the universe I call God. And just tell God what you want. Uh-huh. And here's why. Years ago, I said to God, I really would like to go back to school, but I can't afford it. I don't have time. I'm working. I don't know how I'll make it. Fast forward, and I get a call from a friend saying, can you come to Columbia? I'd like you to come and work for me. Now,
can you come? I love it.
Can you come? Now, listen, there was nothing in there. From my world, I'm like, I had a counselor who told me if I made $10,000 a year, I'd be doing good. That would be a success. Mm-hmm. There was nothing in me that said I should be working at an Ivy League university. And yet, here's one saying, can you come?
Wow.
I happen to be blessed because I come to Columbia, and all of a sudden I realize the tuition is free. I can go to school. And then, oh, my God, then the best thing in the world, they start a program called Negotiation and Conflict Resolution.
I want to say this, you know, because I want to give you an opportunity to tell folks how they can reach out to your organization. We have about 30 seconds left before we're going to go to recording. So I want to warn folks that if they were listening live, they're going to hear the recording end and that they can come back to the archived version of it and hear everything that happened after the recording ended. But I do want to give this opportunity, Laverna, for people to understand how they can contact you and why, what kinds of populations you're serving and how it is that you can be helpful to them and vice versa.
So my website is www.defianthope.com, DefianthHope.com. You can go to the website. You'll find all kinds of ways to get a hold of me. Everything about the organization is there. The mediation services that I offer, the negotiation services that I offer, the facilitation services that I offer, speaking, training, and conflict resolution, cultural diversity. It really is all there on the website, www.defianthope.com.
Awesome. I have to say, I so enjoy doing this show because every person who comes on is truly inspiring, and I have to say that you have definitely hit the mark on that, especially with my, clarified understanding or deeper understanding of what you were talking about in the document that you sent to me regarding your family and how things started out for you and the decisions that you've made that have brought you to the place where you are now, where you're contributing to helping folks to be able to see a different way, a peaceful way, an empathetic way of dealing with conflict and dealing with the world. And I really want to commend you for having lived this journey as you are and contributing to the world the way that you are going forward. This is a wonderful, wonderful thing that you're doing, Laverna.
Well, I thank you so much for taking the time and allowing me to talk. It's been an absolute pleasure for me. Thank you.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for listening. We are here each week with a new story from the front lines of mediation. I hope that you've enjoyed this broadcast and that you will join us again. I'm going to end the show with music, as I usually do, and today I've chosen a piece by Brandon Ross, who is a favorite musician of mine. It is from his album Costume, which is available for sale on iTunes and in other locations where you can find music. I encourage folks to support our independent musicians and to buy the music. The piece is called Race Face, and based on our conversation, knowing that we were going to talk about what was happening in the 60s and this riot in this small town and so forth, I wanted to share this piece with you. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you join us again next week. Bye for now.